Welcome to the New York Times Popcast. You're really on 2X right now, huh? Of music, news, and criticism, I'm your host, John Caramonico.
Well, you thought I'd be waiting up when you came home last night. You'd been out with all the boys and you ended up half tied. But liquor and love, they just don't mix. Leave the bottle or me behind.
We lost Loretta Lynn last week, or depending when you're listening to this. 2 weeks ago, Loretta Lynn passed away at 90 years old, a long, rich, lustrous, varied, fascinating, sui generis career. And we're going to talk about Loretta this week on the show. Julie Hyde's going to be with us in just a minute to get into the weeds on the art, the politics, the aesthetics, etc. Obviously, when someone this established and this important passes away, even at a very old age, it's hard not to think about how this person's music translates into the present moment, which is like a little bit of like a false narrative often. But with Loretta, it does feel particularly poignant. And I expect that we're going to get into that in the ways in which things that she did in the 60s and 70s that were novel and perhaps uncharted water still feel beyond pointed and potent right now. I'm coming off of a very long weekend of running around and events. I do want to say congratulations to Rachel and Lloyd, who had a tremendous wedding this past weekend. Truly a privilege and a joy to be down there with you. So shout out to Rachel and Lloyd and to everybody who was down there thugging it out in Delaware with me. Let's get into Loretta. Julie Hyde is here. Julie, welcome.
Thanks for having me back.
Julie is a contributor at NPR Music, a scholar of all things country music, and we're going to get in the weeds about the arc of Loretta's career and also maybe just tap in a tiny bit as to why people were being so frisky last week on the internet. But I don't want to spend too much time on that because friskiness, at least that sort, is not what we're shooting for on this episode of podcast. Julie, let's talk just a tiny bit about how Loretta herself spoke about the nature of her music, specifically in the early years. How did she present the work that she did in the context of the country music scene of the day?
First of all, I think it's worth noting that when she made her entry into writing songs and performing them live and then recording them and then driving around to radio stations and promoting her records, she was very clear about the fact that that was the idea of her husband, Doolittle Lynn, Mooney Lynn. He was known by many names. She emphasized that it was his idea, that he identified talent in her when he heard her singing around the house and kind of pushed her, nudged her on her way. And then she took it from there and began writing her own stuff and putting it out there. And I mean, it really wasn't too long before she started to get a little bit of that chart traction and then explored Nashville and started to find the right people there, especially Patsy Cline to look to. But I think it's really a fascinating thing to hear an artist say, hey, it wasn't my idea. It wasn't my ambition. I followed through with it, but my husband pushed me to do this.
And again, the pre-Patsy moment and then the post-Patsy moment, I mean, that's a fairly pivotal turn in Loretta's early arc, the moving to Nashville. Loretta's a mother of four children, I believe, when she first really starts taking off as a musician and is doing what Mooney tells her to do. That is uncommon, as you underscore. That is not common. But the frankness with which she would share that obviously sets a template for the type of records that she ended up becoming extremely well known for making.
Yeah, and I mean, she definitely did point to getting to know Patsy Cline as a pivotal thing in kind of freeing her up to write and sing and move professionally in a different way too. But I kind of look at all of this, the way that she told her origin story, the way she wrote it, the way she talked about it as, I mean, it's all kind of part of the tapestry of how she told her whole backstory, her whole, you know, her whole mythology, her whole approach to autobiography, because the whole thing throughout it all is that tension between emphasizing humble roots and that she never lost sight of that, never lost touch with where she came from, but also that she was holding on to that, but also moving forward into the modern world at the same time. And I think, like, when I look at her life, and especially the way that she told and retold her story and refined her telling of her story, it's that new versions of new iterations of that tension playing out throughout it. So yeah, so when she says this is how I got started, it's a way of saying I came from the holler and never thought that I would leave and become a big country star, but I sure have the drive to do it. Like, both of those things being true at the same time.
Butcher Holler. We've somehow made it 5 minutes in without saying the words Butcher Holler. But that stops now. One of the things when we were sort of chatting about this previously was you had mentioned you want to talk a little bit about class positioning. And I think, obviously, Loretta's autobiography, where she came from, the particularities of the circumstance of her young life, both before she met Du and also in the early years of their marriage. Was that atypical for a country performer of that era to truly come from those kinds of humble circumstances?
That's the kind of story that I hear often when I go to the medallion ceremony, the Country Music Hall of Fame induction, when artists who are older, generations back, are being inducted. That's the kind of life experience or point of origin that would have been more common further back. But I think that generationally now, like when she passed and I had to think of a couple of artists to bring on a show, I thought of some singer-songwriters who are also from Kentucky, from rural areas, and deal with class and, you know, working class identity and rural identity in rich and complex ways. And those were Angelina Presley and Kelsey Walden. And Angelina Presley is also a coal miner's daughter, but that reality, the way that she writes about that and talks about that, is much more of a middle class reality where she didn't have the brand name Keds. She had the knockoff Keds. So when I think about that, I mean, it's more of the reality that we heard in the origin stories, the mythologies of Dolly Parton and Johnny Cash and contemporaries. It looks and feels and sounds different now, even when artists are coming from a blue collar background, just because of the middle classing of America, or the upward mobility. The country format itself was sort of selling itself as having an audience that had buying power and was upwardly mobile in the 60s and 70s, you know, that could buy those cars and refrigerators,
but who were embracing nostalgia for a simpler version of America, a simpler version perhaps in their own personal histories or families' histories, and somehow the entertainment, the country music itself, trying to thread the needle between those two things, the aspiration and the nostalgia.
Exactly. Loretta Lynn, we don't need to make the argument that she was the first or the only to do any of these things, but I think that in the way that she embodied and portrayed her life experience and learned how to very savvily and accessibly tell those stories and retell those stories and re-record them, you know, later on in her career. It's just the archetype, like doing it in such a definitive and vital way.
So Loretta is releasing singles really beginning in the early 60s. And by the mid 60s, this is when we get to the stuff that the most casual fans will be aware of. At the beginning of the show, we were listening to Don't Come Home A-Drinkin' with Lovin' On Your Mind, which TBH, if you switch the verbs, probably still works. Don't come home a-lovin' with drinking on your mind. Don't do that either. Strong recommend. just throwing that out there for people. Let's also listen right now to another ice cold classic. And we all know it. It's You Ain't Woman Enough to Take My Man. This is that tough talk, which I'm into. Frankly, it feels very late 2010s Cardi B. You know what I mean? Like this is the template right here.
Salty, unvarnished.
And also like real main character energy, if we're being honest, like extreme main character energy. Tell me a little bit about this streak, because there's a bunch of them, and some of the songs are directed at a woman who is trying to insert herself into Loretta's marriage. Some of them are directed towards the husband. She's really like firing missiles in all directions. But talk to me a little bit about this era of songs, because I think the radicalism of them in the moment, in the context, they still feel, frankly, quite radical. But in that moment, I imagine especially so.
The way she talked about it at the time, the way she wrote about it in her first memoir, Coal Miner's Daughter, she would just say, in a very matter-of-fact way, I'm simply writing about my life. I'm simply writing about what I know or what I see in my marriage or actual interactions. But I think that we should recognize that she was savvier than that. There's craft to this. There is wit to this. In the song, Don't Come Home A-Drinkin', I mean, that is a high watermark in my mind. That, and part of why I think it went down easily or more easily and people could take pleasure from it, even as cold as it was, is how she delivered it, how she sang it. I loved her singing as much as her songs. And I mean, in the verses of that, she uses vibrato to kind of soften the blow a little bit there when she's calling out this lousy, drunken, sexually aggressive male partner, you know, and then she hits those bright and clear and fired up notes that she circles around to those high notes during the chorus. And that is, I think, the way that she would kind of phrase in a way that might feel like she was shooting from the hip, like it's an outburst, you know, but you could also feel her grinning sometimes. You could, I mean, actually hear that or hear the twinkle in her eye.
Even when the subject matter gets darker, like, because I'm thinking about Fist City. There is some mischief, maybe isn't the right word.
No, I mean, mischievous, yeah.
Oh, you think so? Okay, let's rock with it.
I think that's on point.
Even when it's dark.
Yeah, because there's an element of her knowing what she's doing, but sort of playing up the naivety a little bit, but still very clearly drawing lines that had been difficult to draw in the domestic sphere, especially for rural women and working class women before then. I mean, drawing some very clear lines about bodily autonomy and about, in some cases, the division of labor in the household and agency, all that kind of stuff. And I mean, it's a little weird to think about the number of songs like Fist City and You Ain't Woman Enough to Take My Man that she did. I mean, just because it's like her taking on another woman. But I think one way to hear those is as that's her playing out the real knee-jerk emotional reaction that would be natural to have in some of those situations, you know, especially if the undertone is a real weariness about the man doing it again, being a dog all over again, and knowing good and damn well that he's going to do it over again. There are all of those layers to it. So I love that she could be simultaneously like creating this, like saying things that were radical to say, or striking a posture that was radical to redefining like how a woman could exist in the domestic sphere, but doing it in, I don't want to downplay the savvy that was involved in doing that and the craft in the writing of those songs, the humor and how she put them across. She laid down so many great humorous performances. And I think, too, I mean, you know, obviously there's that long history of cornpone humor in country music and all the barn dance variety shows that had those kind of comedic performers and the String Beans and Grandpa Joneses and Minnie Pearls of the world up through like Hee Haw, how that was presented on the TV show Hee Haw. And that often was intended to let country people feel in on the joke, you know, to kind of like play on perceptions. But I feel like what was really important about how Loretta Lynn used humor was to not just strictly aim it toward nostalgia or toward the past, but to aim it toward what was changing right in her midst, you know, or the things that she wanted to change. And that gave it a little more bite or a little more edge, the way that she used humor.
Here's something that struck me in re-listening to some of these old Loretta songs. Here is a woman writing and singing songs about a ne'er-do-well husband, the women that he is philandering with. And all I can think of is Summer Walker. Right? And I am thinking people like do this like Talmudic research with like Taylor Swift songs, right? About like which person is it about? Like which reference? What word is reference to this? And we think of these modern examples of singer-songwriters, especially encoding the truth about their personal lives, like the truest truth into these songs. And the reason I think of Summer Walker specifically is because a lot of this most recent Summer Walker album is about the collapse and troubles of the relationship that she had with London on the Track, who is the father of her child and also produced a bunch of the songs. And there's Loretta in like 1966 or whatever, writing, singing songs about her failure of a husband who happens to also be her manager.
Yeah, and not being remotely coy about it.
Not even slightly. Like no Easter eggs. This is not an Easter egg thing. This is first person narrative.
And I mean, she would joke about trying to send him a message or make things clear to him through certain lines of certain songs. I can only imagine what those exchanges were like when she played him those songs for the first time. I was not there to witness any of that, but it is really striking. And I mean, even more so when you think about at the time that she was doing that work, it was very much not the norm, not the normal widespread template in country music for a hit recording artist to be writing a great many of her own songs. I mean, obviously she recorded outside songs as well, but it was not a given that an artist would be saying, hey, I'm performing from an autobiographical vantage point, you know, or that is the posture that I am striking. That is what I'm showing you. That is what I'm telling you. So that made it, I mean, even more striking and more complicated still. By the time that she was a very successful recording artist and touring extensively and it had her final children, the twins, the reality turned on its head to where she was gone quite a bit and it was her husband that was staying home and raising them.
Take that, a lot of time. Right? Can we play another song from this era, which has a title that maybe has not aged terribly well, but still a great song? Can we listen to Your Squaw's on the Warpath? Yeah. My apologies. It was a number three hit. So, you
right.
Know, different time. This is Your Squaw's on the Warpath.
Well, that far water that you've been drinking makes you feel bigger. The chief you're shrinking since you've been on that love making diet. Now, don't hand me that old piece of pie. There ain't no pie.
I think we should maybe dip our toes a tiny bit into some of the discursive friction of the last like 10 days. And a lot of this boils down to one word, and that word is feminist. Is she, isn't she, was she, wasn't she? And perhaps more pressingly, can you write or perform a song that espouses values that are consistent with feminism without claiming that title or having that title imposed upon you? It's important to remember that Loretta Lynn did not take to that word and politically was often maybe aligned with people who were not on the left. And
like
I know that that's
George
a struggle.
George Wallace, for instance.
Yeah, not a great moment. Talk a little bit about that, because I felt like it was settled business that you could maybe write a feminist song but not own the title. I thought that was settled business, but last week on Twitter, it was anything but settled business.
To some degree, that is just sort of like the automatic collapsing of complex perspectives and life experiences to a simplistic thing. But I keep thinking about that when she was writing about, speaking about, you know, mentioning in her book, Coal Miner's Daughter, that she did not identify with women's lib. She was saying those things when the women's liberation movement and feminism were identified with things like, you know, Ms. Magazine and Gloria Steinem and those kinds of figures. And those figureheads, those institutions, those movements, probably to Loretta Lynn didn't seem like they had much to do with her and her life and her concerns and those of many of the members of her audience, though she considered her audience. There was a huge class divide there that we have to acknowledge, because she probably saw those expressions of feminism at that time as being for educated and city dwelling and middle class white women, you know, by and large, which is to not acknowledge or to erase or minimize that there were organizing efforts done in, you know, rural areas, Appalachian areas, by Southerners led by figures like Fannie Lou Hamer and Hazel and Alice and others like that, that did do activist work or movement work. What Loretta Lynn was contending with and what she spelled out very clearly and very playfully in the song One's on the Way is this distance in class and, you know, regional sensibility and all of that. You want me to do a dramatic recitation or you want to play the song?
No, we got, I mean, frankly, both. let's listen to a little bit of One's on the Way and we'll be back in a minute. We'll see what Julie's filling up for on the other side.
The pill may change the world tomorrow, but meanwhile, today, Topeka, the flies are a-buzzing, the dog is a-barking, and the floor needs a scrubbing. One needs a spanking, and one needs a hugging, Lord.
One's on the way.
Oh, gee, I hope it ain't twins again.
I'm Kevin Roos.
And I'm Casey Newton.
We're technology reporters and the hosts of Hard Fork, a new show from the New York Times.
A hard fork is a programming term for when you're building something that gets really screwed up. So you take the entire thing, break it, and start over.
And that's a little bit what it feels like right now in the tech industry. Like these companies that you and I have been writing about for the past decade, they're all kind of struggling to stay relevant.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the energy and money in Silicon Valley is shifting to totally new ideas. Crypto, the metaverse, AI. It feels like a real turning point.
And all this is happening so fast, some of it's so strange. I just feel like I'm texting you constantly, like, what is this story? Explain this to me.
And so we're going to talk about these stories. We're going to bring in other journalists, newsmakers, whoever else is involved in building this future to explain to us what's changing and why it all matters.
Hard Fork from the New York Times.
Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back. Julie Heights here. We're talking Loretta Lynn. One's on the way. Julie, you gonna sing? You're gonna recite? What are we doing here?
I mean, I was just gonna do a dramatic recitation, but I mean that would not top the woman herself singing it, you know?
Okay. I'll accept that answer. Why do you think in the current conversation? First of all, I'm reminded a lot of, I feel like there was an era of journalism, music journalism, let's call late 2000s to like mid 2010s, internet focused music journalism, not internet focused, but internet era, where there were these moments that felt like aha, like gotcha moments, where you'd ask someone if they were a feminist. And then if they said that they weren't, then that became a whole problem. And I feel like this would happen with pop stars. This would happen with female rappers. No one ever asked male rappers if they're feminists. No, if someone would like to ask, if someone would like to ask Future if he's a feminist, I'd love to hear the answer to that question. It always struck me, though, as like they're false umbrella categories, right? Like you want to ask a person as a journalist, right? You want to ask them about their value system. You want to ask them about what they find meaning in. You want to ask them about what motivates their decision making. Your version of feminism might not be the exact same version that I think of when I think of feminism. That might not be that version that the next person thinks of. So to ask someone who maybe hasn't thought very hard about first wave, second wave, third wave, et cetera, and say, are you this, always felt like a little bit of a trick question, even if they gave the quote unquote right answer. So it seems particularly disingenuous to me to kind of be debating this 40 years after the fact or 50 years after the fact in the wake of Loretta's passing.
it does seem a little beside the point when you can just wade into what she showed us in songs that she wrote and how she spoke about her audience, how she wrote about her story, and even how she moved in her career. She was constantly acknowledging the reality that she was operating within male-dominated spaces in her home, in her industry, every facet of it, in the world that she inhabited. So she was acknowledging those things and then very much acknowledging things about that she was dissatisfied with, that she expected to change. I wouldn't have ever expected her to give, I don't know, you know, a certain kind of academically on point response to any kind of question like that.
The songs themselves, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. The songs themselves are so rich and so kind of vivid with emotional detail and inner life narrative that the notion that they do or do not hew to like some nebulous cloud of ideology always feels very strange to me. I think it's probably a good point to maybe check in with Rated X about what it's like to be in the world as a divorced woman.
The double standards that a divorced woman faces and the men that are on the prowl for those divorced, damaged goods.
Yeah, whatever that is, we don't support it on Popcast. But let's listen to Popcast is life. We got to establish some moral guidelines here. Here's Rated X. Rated X is a very big hit for Loretta Lynn in the early 70s. And we'll get to The Pill, which comes not that long after that. But what do you make of the fact that at this point, she's a decade-ish into a career of recording and releasing very successful records? This is the year she wins Entertainer of the Year at the CMAs in 72. This song feels as forward-thinking, as shocking, as radical, more so, frankly, than a lot of contemporary pop approaches to this. Like, this is a much more serrated version of a song about divorce than, my apologies, but anything on the last Kacey Musgraves album. You know what I mean? Not just to think, just to throw one thing out there. And it is also a number one country song. It's the number one country song in the country at that time. What is happening to make that happen?
Part of it is that, you know, back to that hearty, knowing humor, the way that she delivers. And when your best friend's husband says to you, you sure started looking good, you should have known he would, and he would if he could. I mean, it's tightly and effectively written, but also it's just so knowing the way that she delivers it. There's a wink to it and a grin. And I think that certainly is part of what put it over and made it popular and accessible for people of all genders. I was just looking at in the book, Coal Miner's Daughter, she says, most of my fan club is women, which is how I want it. The men have enough things going for them in this life. We women have got to stick together. And then she goes on from there. But when you think about her viewing her fan base, the fan base that she wanted or wanted to connect with. I mean, not to marginalize any other people who also have been part of that fan base and legitimately so and have loved her music. But that was some insight into who she wanted to be speaking to, women who in one way or another shared aspects of her life experience and where she was coming from, which I think was an emboldening thing for her. And recording a song like Rated X and knowing that people would get it. It would resonate. They would nod their heads and say, yes, I know what she speaks of.
So the CMA Entertainer of the Year Award started in 67. And from what I can see in the nominees, she's the first woman nominated the year prior in 71. And then she's the winner in 1972. Why do you think that she was able to cut through this particular bro fest at that moment? because some people maybe would have argued, hey, someone who was not speaking so frankly, someone who was not as radical in their songwriting or presentation might be a better kind of like sleeper candidate to infiltrate into this very, very, very stiff boys club. Do you think that her success reflected that women were always huge in the country music marketplace in terms of audience and were waiting for someone like her to arrive? Or did it bring new listeners in who maybe were feeling put off by everything else that was there and then said, aha, okay, now this I get, this I'm with?
It's probably all of the things that you mentioned and also incredible drive and persistence on her part once she began down that road, because she was also creating a lane for herself professionally and ultimately starting different business ventures and publishing and booking and that kind of thing. And she was fashioning a whole way of sharing her persona and her story and her mythology with the world over time in the writing of her books, which became, you know, the huge film, made her a pop culture figure well beyond those who'd probably been familiar with her music up to that point, and all of the touring and the performing and creation of a tourist destination, Hurricane Mills. She was not the only artist to be doing this kind of multifaceted fashioning of a persona and a presence for fans to engage with, but she just did it so well. And it was thorough. It was consistent in reflecting what she wanted to show about herself and where she was coming from. You know, like the you're looking at me, you're looking at country kind of idea was what she pointed to over and over and over again. And I think that just doing all of the things and continually doing them with persistence and with excellence and having written so much of her own material, all of that was part of the building process to build a career that is this iconic entity. Just the fact that she did live so long, we got to see every phase of legacy building, legacy making. You know, I mean, this is someone who went into the Country Music Hall of Fame, I believe, back in the 80s. You know, that's quite a while ago at this point in time, and then was with us long enough for there to be a bazillion tribute shows and tribute albums, and to even have that moment with Jack White 20 years ago. There'd been these other models, especially the Johnny Cash model, probably most famously, you know, when he did all those albums with Rick Rubin, that kind of stripped away all of the showbiz aspects of what he had done and just leaned into the Man in Black aspect of it and the grim, you know, staring death in the face side of it, and made him seem authentic and cool to a new generations of maybe rock loving listeners. When Jack White teamed up with her to make a much more garage rock album, I thought it was interesting that it combined her hard country edge with a garage rock kind of attacks. And then they were reminding people or introducing to a new audience to the way that she told her story. That very much fits into this model of authenticity or coming from a pure and humble place that it scans that way, it reads that way to rock fans.
Yeah, I do want to push back on that a tiny bit for a couple of reasons.
Okay, do it.
I feel like the narrativization around that album was one of like recasting a legend, but also kind of like as if she'd been like locked in a castle for 20 years, right? But she had been released, I mean, not consistently, but she'd been releasing music through the 90s into the early 2000s. In my mind, it's a Jack White record featuring Loretta Lynn. There's always something that felt a little bit false about how it was presented. And you and I both know, as members of the media, we love a good narrative. Oh, Jack White, garage rock resuscitator, is now resuscitating country music icon, perhaps fallen from the top, but could be brought back up. That album is not a huge financial success. That's not a career rehabilitator. And frankly, what I often think of, and this was actually really tough, I reread something that I wrote It had to be 2008 or 2009. It was one of the early concert reviews that I wrote when I came to the paper. And it's Loretta Lynn playing at, like, I think it was Bergen Pack, like one of these like kind of community theater type spaces in New Jersey. And we're not immediately after Van Leer Rose, let's say 4 years after that. This was a tough show. She barely remembered the lyrics to songs. She kind of did a fair amount of rambling. The backing band is family members. You know, it's very clear that they are cocooning her and protecting her and giving her the opportunity to perform, frankly, the most comfortable, obvious songs in the most comforting of environments. It's made me even struggle more with what Van Leer Rose purported to be. Because if indeed this was at where she is in her kind of like creative development and also in her life and the struggles of aging on stage, you know, they're terrible. Van Leer Rose felt even maybe like a touch more disingenuous than I had felt like it was in 2004. Let's listen to something off Van Leer Rose. There are some lovely songs. I don't mean to diminish the songs. There are some lovely songs on this record. Let's listen to what was the single from that record. That's Miss Being Mrs. Incredible song.
I lie here all alone in my bed of memories. I'm dreaming of your sweet kiss. Oh, how you loved on me.
Who knows what she actually thought about what the project represented for her.
Or if she even thought if it represented anything. You know, I think we might have taken it more seriously as a project than she did.
I was thinking more about the people who used that as their initial entry point to her music. Because, I mean, obviously, when you have a film made about your life that wins an Oscar and is that popular and widely known, then you are a pop culture figure that is to some degree simply unavoidable. People are going to encounter you in one way or another, but it still might take something beyond that to grab someone's attention to the extent that they'll actually listen to the music and engage with it and focus on it in any kind of real or sustained way. So I wonder more about how it affected or added a little bit to her listenership at that moment. But I mean, she did more of a reboot when she teamed up with Dolly Parton and Tammy Wynette and made an album with them.
That kind of underscores one of the tensions maybe that we've returned to time and again over this conversation, which is what other people want from you or want you to be versus what you actually truly are. And it's interesting, in a career that is predicated, certainly in the earliest years, on a raw, uncut version of autobiographical truth. It's interesting to see the shift in those in the later years of other people trying to become the interpreters of Loretta Lynn rather than letting Loretta Lynn be in front.
The last albums that were released, many of the songs were her newly reinterpreting some of her beloved songs from many years back.
I think maybe what scared me off from those records was seeing her perform a few years ago, 15 years ago, and frankly, the anxiety that it induced in me about seeing someone that I had so intensely associated with this kind of presence and authority. I had a very similar experience with a Glen Campbell concert, like a late life Glen Campbell concert. It was just really rough. It was really, really rough. And that Loretta show, I remember driving back to my house from the show and just like my head was spinning. And I was like, I can't believe that I have to capture and document what that was, because that was hard.
I understand the feeling of loss when you witness a great performer who seems diminished. And I mean, thinking about that, she grew up not only on Appalachian singing, you know, what would come to be known as bluegrass and old time music, that like keening, unornamented kind of singing that really cut through, but also that early honky tonk music, Kitty Wells and Ernest Tubb, and then Patsy Cline, too. There were aspects of her singing that could be conversational. I love that she had that husky timbre to her voice. I mean, she gave some really rocking, rollicking performances over time, you know, on Mississippi Woman, Louisiana Man, and lots of others as well. But her phrasing could be so clever, interesting.
Well, she had a flexibility. Sometimes I feel like, and this is particularly true, I think, in contemporary country music, and maybe slightly less so in earlier generations, but I feel like there's a lack of vocal flexibility song to song. Like oftentimes a song on album three is indistinguishable, like from a vocal tone perspective, is indistinguishable from album one or album five. People just sort of land on a thing. It kind of works. And then 5 years will pass. And that was something that maybe wasn't on the table for someone like Loretta in her era. But even if it was, it seems like she wouldn't have settled for that anyway.
It's really interesting to think of her as like having a hard country sensibility in her vocal attack, because she was produced for so many years by Owen Bradley, obviously, and he was doing a little bit more of a lean and compact version of Nashville sound production on a lot of that stuff. But she did sometimes have those very smooth backing vocals behind her, and occasionally strings too, but her voice would just cut through and could be so cutting, and her phrasing could be just punchy and clipped. And I think it's fascinating that she, you know, wound up sort of helping her younger sister, Crystal Gayle, enter the industry well after her as such a different kind of singer, you know, like adult contemporary crossover success, jazz tinged, pop leaning balladeer.
We have gotten this far. We haven't talked about the pill. It's a good note to kind of go out on it. We sort of touched on the themes a little bit earlier, not the themes of the song necessarily, but the way it was received. So The Pill, an incredibly important song, always important, but also here we are post Roe v. Wade. And it feels very poignant that a song like this 40 some odd years ago was already delineating the problems. it's just very, as they say, hashtag team early. I don't know if it was banned to country radio, who could say? But when you talk a little bit about The Pill in the moment and its reception, what do we learn both about Loretta's positioning and also how far country music as a scene and a kind of worldview was prepared to expand around what Loretta was putting into it?
At the time, it was an incredibly daring song to record, you know, saying, hey, I'm glad for this tool that is going to enable women to have bodily autonomy and to liberate themselves from perpetual pregnancy. If you're not going to look out for us, then we will do it for ourselves. I mean, that was something that the popularity of it, despite whatever the particulars of resistance at country radio actually looked like, the popularity of it, I mean, it wasn't just purely backlash that it stirred up. There was actual real connection.
And it was also a hit. The song was a hit. It wasn't like an obscure B-side.
It was a major song. And, you know, I mean, it was simultaneously issuing a warning to men or a threat. This is coming. This is available to us and we're going to use it. But also, there are a lot of funny lines, a lot of one-liners in that song, a lot of chicken comparisons in that song, which made it gave it a very down-home presentation in terms of, you know, language and imagery and that kind of thing. And you could chuckle at it at the same time.
It softened, in so much as it was a blow, it softened the blow a little bit and allowed it to get played on radio to the extent that it got played on radio and to become part of the social fabric of the era, not simply just a song.
And probably the one next to the song Coal Miner's Daughter, the one that I have seen invoked the most over and over again.
Again, media people love narratives. That's for a different episode.
That's true. I did find two other tiny, interesting tidbits when I was looking back at both of her books that are not related to The Pill.
Let's hear the tidbits as we go out. Tell us what the tidbits are.
One thing that I found wonderful and amusing is that in her second book, Still Woman Enough, she wrote about how ready she was for the Y2K predictions to come true. She wasn't the least bit worried, least bit afraid of computers and the electrical grid going down, because she wove that into her worldview of scoffing at city folks who don't know how to, you know, survive, because it, for her, it came back again to the resilience and resourcefulness of rural people in the face of all kinds of hardship. So I was amused, delighted by seeing her bring that thread back around at the Y2K moment.
The sensible Y2K take that we didn't know we needed, but we needed.
And then there was this is such a tiny thing, but I don't know. It just seemed telling to me that, you know, in the photos in the copy of Coal Miner's Daughter that I have, which is a very musty book, she wrote a caption for this backstage photo, and she's just kind of lost in thought, looking pensive, straight faced, not smiling. And she wrote, "Never mind those pictures of me laughing. Somebody caught me sitting around thinking about my life. This is the way I really am inside." And I just took that as a reminder of the savvy that was in play, you know, a reminder that she was taking in the world around her, the world as she knew it, and processing it and responding to it, and truly not strictly shooting from the hip, even though she was a master at performing in a way that felt like that kind of immediacy, shooting from the hip.
That is the number one trick. It's thought through, but it comes off the hip. Loretta Lynn, a giant of that particular skill. Julie, what a privilege. Such a thrill. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us at podcast@nytimes.com. Get in the Facebook group, tinyurl.com/podcast Facebook. Get in the Discord, tinyurl.com/podcast Discord. You can subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get your audio content: Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, etc., etc. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back next week. Now, everybody, grab a loved one, grab a stuffed animal, get under a blanket. Here's the pill.
Mini skirts, hot pants, and a few little fancy frills. Yeah, I'm making up for all those years since I've got the pill. I'm tired of all your crowing.